Well, that would be the rated R version. I think it could be done tastefully, as tastefully as maybe a Grindhouse movie could be.
Right.
But no, that's not the version we get.
Yeah, Swamp Thing is rated PG after all, and I'm kind of joking a little bit, but I would like to see that version of the movie too,
Well,
kind of,
he
but.
would have an enormous Schunstiger.
Hello, and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Podcast. We're your hosts, Matt Levine.
And Vincent Hannum.
And we're talking about all of our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time.
Traditional kaiju, creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between, all strange beasts welcome here.
Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the show notes.
Government agents, scientists, soldiers, master criminals, secret formulas, monsters and midgets. None of them belong in this swamp. Only one thing does. The Swamp Thing.
You're kind of trouble.
The Swamp Thing.
Dangerous neighborhood.
Adrienne Barbeau and the Swamp Thing, an outrageous pair, in the incredible adventure that grows on you or all over you. The Adventures of the Swamp Thing.
Alex!
The comic book legend lives.
Vincent, how you doing?
So good, so good. I got 3 days of school left as of this recording, but folks listening to us in the future, I'm a free man. It is summer vacation. I can't wait to stay up late, to my detriment, but that's what summer's all about.
I don't think that's to your detriment. You're going to be watching monster movies all night. You're going to be like recreating Jaws at like Minnesota lakes. It's going to be great.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. That's an idea.
It could be like a Purple Rain Jaws mashup in Lake Minnetonka.
That sounds insane and less scary than just Jaws in a lake. People do that. They'll get the floaties and they'll watch it on the screen in a pool. And I feel like I would still be too terrified, even in a pool, to do that.
Yeah, I could not do it. I mean, even when I'm swimming in like the deep end of a pool, I always imagine that like I'm going to look around and like a gray white's going to be coming at me. So I could definitely not do that.
I think Jaws was as long as like a normal swimming pool.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Maybe not an Olympic pool, just like your backyard swimming pool.
Yeah. Good old animatronic Bruce. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which somehow makes him even scarier, in my opinion.
Mm.
This is, as we know, as we've talked about on the podcast before, this is the 50th anniversary of Jaws this summer.
That's right. And for friends of the podcast listening out there, or enemies, call in on the Kaiju hotline or just write us an email. Tell us about your memories with Jaws. I want to collect them all. I want to package them up and release a special Jaws-themed episode later this summer to celebrate our favorite shark movie. So please keep that in mind as you're thinking about this episode and thinking about Jaws.
Maybe the best monster movie ever. Certainly has a claim to that title.
Arguably.
Yeah. Man, I mean, I love the friends of the podcast, but I'm maybe even more fascinated by the enemies of the Camp Kaiju podcast. I want to know who they are. If they're out there, I want to know more about them.
I mean, they are out there. I don't read those comments on Mina's mailbox.
Good, good.
No, there aren't many, but one day I'll share them with you and you friends of the podcast. But, you know, we like to keep things positive here.
Yeah, maybe I don't want to know about them. Maybe I take that back a little bit. But to anybody listening out there, anybody leaving comments on our YouTube or, you know, whatever channel you're on, Instagram, Facebook, thank you. We appreciate you, especially the friends of the podcast.
Absolutely.
So what have you seen recently, Vincent? Any good monster movies?
Yeah, I mean, not to go rehash everything we just talked about.
Yeah, <that's fine.
laughs> Maybe I'll release that as a special content. But I saw the movie Crawl from 2019, set in Florida, about killer alligators. Much better than you might give it credit for. I would highly recommend. It's campy. It's got heart. And some of the craziest animals I've seen in a creature feature. So would recommend Crawl.
Are the gators, I assume they're not real live alligators. Are they CGI in that movie?
They are CGI.
Okay.
Which is not my preference. But the things these gators are doing, I just have to give the creators a little forgiveness. Because, I don't know, the things these gators are doing, I can imagine would cost so much more money to try to pull off in camera.
Yeah.
With either live alligators or animatronics.
Yeah. So. You don't want them to actually kill anybody on camera. That would be unfortunate. So.
Right. And it's the type of thing where, like, if this movie was made in the 70s, maybe it'd be like a dummy full of blood and guts that you see ripped apart.
Right.
Is that animal cruelty? Like, there's a lot of standards have changed.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
No, it's fair for sure. I mean, probably Alligator by Lewis Teague from 1980, I think, is the epitome of that subgenre of monster movie, killer gators. But yeah, Crawl sounds great. I'll have to check it out.
Definitely. How about you?
Oh, I saw a bad monster movie, Species 2. I did want to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I don't think I mentioned this in the last podcast that we did. After we talked about Species, I was excited to revisit some of the sequels. And yeah, Species 2 is not very good. I don't think I will be going any further in that series, but we'll see. Maybe I'll change my mind.
You got to think about it. Sleep on it.
I mean, it was bad, but not like offensively bad. And I have like, what's the best way to put this? A high bar for bad movies or a low bar? I don't know which one it is, but I'll put up with a lot of badness to like be entertained. So maybe I'll watch some more Species movies. We'll see.
I get it though. Being a completionist, I bet there's a part of you that wants to go the distance.
Yeah, right. And part of me wants to believe that like Species 4, The Awakening, is awesome, you know, and like it's a total diamond in the rough and nobody knows about that. I'm sure it's not true. I'm sure it's terrible, but I kind of want to do the due diligence and find out for myself, you know?
Yep.
There are a couple new monster movies in theaters, Bring Her Back, which is kind of like a sequel to Talk to Me, which is a very, very good horror movie from a couple years ago. I don't know if you saw that one.
No, but I've been interested.
That one's good. I might check that out. And then a movie whose title I absolutely love. I know nothing about this movie, but have you heard about Clown in a Cornfield?
I have heard the title.
I'm sorry if I brought this up in the previous episode.
No, you haven't.
I've heard mixed things about that movie. It's probably not very good, but for the title alone, I have to see it.
Is it like Woman Standing in a Front Yard? Whatever that movie was?
Right, Woman in the Yard, yeah.
Woman in the Yard.
It seems very similar to that, but it's a clown instead of a woman.
In a cornfield instead of a yard.
Yeah, that's what I get from the title, but I could be totally wrong about that. I don't know, but that might be a home watch at some point. I don't know. It might already be out of theaters anyway, but I do want to check that out sometime soon. But yeah, a couple monster movies in theaters nowadays.
Yeah, and we got summer coming up, and there's some new releases that we'll get to shortly.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. We do like to commemorate actors and directors and writers and artists who had some role to play in the world of monster movies. So I wanted to say rest in peace to Peter Kwong, who was one of the three storms in Big Trouble in Little China, which is kind of a controversial movie nowadays. I feel like it is not dated all that well. And yet, part of me still wants to celebrate that movie a little bit. It's so imaginative, it's so fun. You know, John Carpenter, a very just stylish, visceral, to use that word again, filmmaker that who he has so many movies that I love. Big Trouble in Little China, problematic, but still, you know, worth watching with some asterisks next to it. But more importantly, rest in peace to Peter Kwong. He was not only in Big Trouble in Little China, he was also in Wonder Woman, Miami Vice, The Golden Child with Eddie Murphy, so many other movies and TV shows. He just died, I think, like a week ago. So thank you, Peter Kwong, to everything you did for monster movies and TV shows.
All right. Rest in peace.
So before we get on, well, let's talk about what we're going to talk about in today's episode, Swamp Thing from 1982 by Wes Craven.
Swamp Thing. Swamp Thang.
That's how you have to say it. It's the only way to say it. That's what we'll be talking about soon. Guilty pleasure territory, maybe, possibly, but we'll find out soon enough.
Yeah, I can't wait to dive into the murky swamp here.
Oh, it is murky indeed. Yeah, for better and for worse, I would
And
say.
swampy.
Very swampy. A lot of swamp bass going on in this movie, figuratively and literally, I would assume anyway. That we probably won't talk about that too much. That's up to the viewer's imagination. But you know, if that's where your mind goes, that's where
That's
mine went. So,
the European cut.
yeah, and indeed, yeah. Oh man, we'll be talking about that too soon enough here. Before we talk more about Swamp Thing, just a few nuts and bolts on Camp Kaiju to cover first. Thank you all so much for hanging out. Please rate and review wherever you listen to Camp Kaiju. You can also send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com or on our Instagram page at camp_kaiju. If you'd like to be a featured voice on the show, you can leave a voicemail at 612-470-2612 telling us about all of your favorite monster movies and memories. As Vincent said before, in particular, if you have any memories about the movie Jaws, please let us know. That's kind of our focus for the summer. We're excited to hear about that. Please also check out our website, campkaijupodcast.com, for more reviews and special content. And finally, you can find some merchandise at campkaiju.threadless.com. Some really great stuff on there, some cool new designs. I love all the new stuff that we have on the website, so definitely check that out. You can also become a patron at patreon.com/campkaiju for discounts, priority comments, and access to any live events. We do hope to have some updates about live events soon. More to come on that. But yeah, thank you again to all of our patrons. We really appreciate all of your support. Jason, Chris, Sean, Peggy, and our anonymous patron. And this is news to me. Do we have a new patron, Vincent?
We do. So welcome, everybody, Chris B. And we can't thank Chris enough for their support. But now we have two Chrises, Matt. How are we going to differentiate them? Well, our first Chris has a nickname on their Patreon account called Beast Drool. So I, if it's okay with you, Chris, out there, you will henceforth be known as Beast Drool, and Chris B will be Chris B.
Crispy.
Chris.
I like it.
All right. So thank you all, and you patrons out there, you'll be the first to know about any upcoming live events. That's just part of the perks of being a patron. You just get the inside scoop a little bit before the rest of you all out there. But you all listening, please check us out on Patreon. You could become a free member, just kind of wet your whistle there a little bit if you're not ready to commit. But whenever you are, we are. Let me, how do I, how should I phrase this?
We're waiting with open arms.
With eyes wide open.
Well, We just need to play the entirety of that Creed song at this point in the episode. I hope that happens. We'll have to buy the rights. That'll blow our entire Camp Kaiju budget, but it's going to be worth it. Guaranteed.
Our live event is with Creed.
What? The big reveal happens now. I had no idea, man. All right, back to monster movies, back to Camp Kaiju. What happened at this point in time in monster movie history? This episode will be released in mid-June-ish or so. So, you know, I like to kind of look back to what happened 10 or 20 or 30 years ago in monster movie history. Vincent, any of these titles, do you want to call them out here?
Yeah, you know what? One that catches my eye from 1985, Cocoon. That is a movie my mom showed me once, and I have only seen it once. But every once in a while, I think back fondly about this movie starring old people and alien pods. And I want to watch it again.
I have like the exact same history with that movie. My parents loved it, and I watched it with them probably two or three times when I was really young. Yeah, it's a very heartwarming, kind of family-friendly movie. And, you know, we talk about a lot of kind of objectionable stuff on Camp Kaiju sometimes, a lot of sex and violence. But this movie is really heartwarming. It's great. So if you haven't seen Cocoon, I think both of us recommend watching it, preferably with your parents.
It seems like a parent movie.
Yeah. I'm glad you called that out. That one's great. Yeah. 1985 was a big year for monster movies. One of them is The Stuff by Larry Cohen, which is like a really great, visceral, sorry, I do overuse that word, but it applies to most of my favorite movies. It's like the creature effects in that movie are really great. It's very funny. But the one that I actually wanted to mention is Life Force by Tobe Hooper from 1985. I feel like that's actually the ancestor to Species, because Life Force has a very beautiful main actress, Matilda May, who is naked for most of that movie. And it's if you don't mind a lot of bad taste, a lot of like vulgarity and immaturity to go along with your monster movies, Life Force is awesome. It looks fantastic. The special effects and the sets and everything else. Tobe Hooper of Texas Chainsaw Massacre fame, like, really does a great job with that movie. So if you're not offended by some sex and nudity, Life Force is very entertaining. Highly recommended.
All right. I will put that on my list.
Yeah. And, you know, we just talked about Species on the podcast, so I feel like I need to mention that kind of, you know, spiritual kind of kinship there.
Totally. And then coming up, I talked about Jurassic World Rebirth. I know you're looking forward to 28 Years Later.
Oh, yeah. I love those movies. 28 Days Later is fantastic. I don't always love Danny Boyle, but yeah, 28 Days Later is really, really good. Love the kind of like gritty digital video vibe of that movie. And then 28 Weeks Later maybe is even better. Like, things are even more apocalyptic. The world is falling apart. I would say the sequel is even scarier than the first one. So I can't wait to see what Danny Boyle is back in the director's chair for the third one, 28 Years Later. I can't wait to see what he does.
We gotta bring some more zombie movies to the podcast, I feel like.
For sure. Yes. It's such a huge subgenre in horror movie history. So many great movies to talk about. Next season, it's going to happen.
And then real quick, Megan 2.0 is dropping at the end of the month. Did you see the first Megan?
I didn't, and I thought it looked pretty bad, but then I heard like surprisingly great things about it.
Yeah. I saw it when it came out. I was happy with the experience. I don't know if I'm going to rush out to see 2.0, but, you know, it's at least a fresh idea that seems to have legs in these, I don't know, kind of doldrummy cinematic waters that we find ourselves in with mainstream Hollywood.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's, you know, again, I haven't seen the first one, but it just seems like an original kind of fun, campy take on like the whole killer doll sort of theme.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm up for that. I definitely want to see it. So that'll be coming out soon as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
What's coming up next on Camp Kaiju? I know our next episode is something you're very excited about, Vincent.
So excited. Everybody listening, get on Robot Jocks. Look it up. It's streaming on Amazon. Rent it. Unfortunately, I just looked up the Blu-ray. I think it's out of print. Terrible. But you can still rent it on Amazon.
It's from 1989. It's a post-apocalyptic world where warfare is settled by each respective country pitting its own giant robot against each other in gladiatorial combat.
Hmm.
So you think Pacific Rim? This is the ancestor of Pacific Rim. It's a lot of stop motion, and it's directed by Stuart Gordon, who did Reanimator, for example. So it's a lot of fun. It's very campy. It's like a Saturday morning cartoon come to life. Would recommend. So we're going to talk about it with Sean Pryor and Sean Childers, two returning guest hosts. It's going to be a ball next episode. So we hope you're a part of it.
I can't wait. I feel a little embarrassed about this, but I had never even heard of this movie until you and Sean brought it to my attention. So
I didn't know about it until 2 years ago.
Okay. Makes me feel a little better.
Don't feel bad. No, it's a cult classic. It's not wide. It was never widely released.
Hmm.
It's just this movie that just flew under the radar for 30 plus years. And now people, I think, are starting to talk about it.
Man, I can't wait.
Yeah.
And we'll have two great guest stars back in the pod. So that'll be a fun episode for sure.
Mm-hmm. And then to round out the first half of our season, you've got a movie.
Yeah, The Company of Wolves by Neil Jordan, which is a movie that I've always wanted to see. It just looks so bizarre and surreal and dreamlike. From what I've read about it, just kind of a metaphor for coming of age, a young woman kind of, you know, entering womanhood, but definitely a lot of horror and fantasy and gothic elements to that movie as well, from as far as I know. So definitely excited to talk about that one too. I think it'll be a weird trip if it's what I expect it to be.
I'm really excited. I've recently learned a little bit about that movie, so thank you for the excuse to watch it. And I think Naomi Osborne, fingers crossed, will be joining us for that episode. So yeah, another good time.
Awesome. I can't wait. And maybe on that episode too, or maybe after that, we'll be announcing season 5, part 2. So
yeah.
More to come soon for sure.
Mm-hmm.
This is Jack Burton in the Pork Chop Express, and I'm talking to whoever's listening out there. It's a pretty amazing planet we live on here, and a man would have to be some kind of fool to think we're all alone in this universe.
There is a hidden world where ancient evil weaves a modern mystery.
What's going on here? Is this some kind of
magic? The darkest magic.
Ow!
They call it Little China.
Finally, we shall bring order out of chaos.
It's where big trouble was waiting for Jack Burton.
Who?
Jack Burton. Me.
Jack.
Jack.
Jack!
They told him to go to hell.
You make one move.
And that's just where he's going.
Somebody, I don't care who, tell me what is going on.
How are you gonna spring us?
I have no idea.
Meet little Melvin. He's a 90-pound weakling. Everyone hated Melvin.
Yeah, I'm gonna take this mop and shove it down your throat.
They teased him.
I wanna do it with you.
Okay.
They taunted him. They tormented him until he had a horrifying accident and fell into a vat of nuclear waste. Transforming little Melvin into a hideously deformed creature of superhuman size and strength. Melvin became the Toxic Avenger. The first superhero born out of nuclear waste. Yes, the muggers and the rapists didn't know what law and order was until the Toxic Avenger came to town.
I don't know what it was, but it saved my life.
For incredible, explosive action, you must see the Toxic Avenger. He's a different kind of hero. The Toxic Avenger is coming to your town. Look out!
The kids of Elm Street don't know it yet, but something is coming to get them.
There's something out there, isn't there?
We just see what's happened.
What did that, Lieutenant? I don't know.
Tina!
There's a coroner got to say. He's in the jaw and puking since he saw it.
You're gonna kill me for sure.
Did you do it?
There was somebody else there.
He was locked in a room with a girl who went in alive and came out in a rubber bag.
No one knows where it came from or who it will visit next.
Nancy? There's something wrong with you. You're imagining things.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Do you believe in the boogeyman?
No.
Whatever you do, don't fall asleep.
She's the only one who can stop it. If she fails,
I'm your boyfriend now, Nancy.
No one will survive. From Wes Craven, director of The Hills Have Eyes and Last House on the Left, a new masterpiece in fantasy terror, Nightmare on Elm Street.
But tonight, again, we are talking about Swamp Thing by Wes Craven from 1982. Yeah. I was just thinking, like, I don't know why I selected this movie. Like, I don't really like comic books all that much, and Swamp Thing was like a big comic book title from the 70s. I guess I'll just start with my personal history with this film, because I didn't really know a lot about it. It's directed by Wes Craven, like I said, and I love A Nightmare on Elm Street. That's probably my favorite horror franchise, and that's the movie that he made right after Swamp Thing, so this is kind of leading up to that huge horror milestone. Wes Craven, of course, has his earlier low-budget horror movies, The Last House on the Left and The Hills Have Eyes, which I like but don't love. And honestly, like, the Scream movies, which Wes Craven also did, are fun, in my opinion, maybe slightly overrated. So, yeah, I don't really know why I chose Swamp Thing to bring to the podcast, but, you know, no spoilers, but I'm glad I did.
Yeah. That's so funny. I mean, yeah, you have no need to defend your choices, but it is funny to think you just woke up one morning and thought, Swamp Thing.
Why not? Yeah. I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, so I'll just leave it there for now. But what's your history with this movie?
None. I mean, it's a name I had known about. And even though I consider myself a comic book person, Swamp Thing is not a mainstream, or wasn't, like, a comic book every kid knows about. And maybe I'm just overgeneralizing, but he's not, like, part of the Justice League.
Right.
Listeners, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't, you know, I never came, maybe I was, because I was a Marvel guy and Swamp Thing is a DC character.
Yeah.
But I will echo, Matt, I think it's interesting how you have talked about not loving superhero movies.
Yeah.
And yet you have brought both this and the Toxic Avenger, which are two superheroes.
Yeah, you're right. It is weird. I also really like Darkman, the Sam Raimi superhero movie from the early 90s. So, I used to like them. I just don't like the modern sort of, like, assembly line Marvel movie. Like, that's what I don't love about it, which seem, you know, not to hate too much on CGI, but, like, I feel like those Marvel movies are like 98% CGI, and it's just like, destroy all the skyscrapers, and there's like one ring that they need to, like, defeat the villain who's going to destroy the universe. And it's like, oh, it's the same thing over and over and over again. That's what I don't like about it. But when they have personality and creativity, generally I would say I do like them.
Yeah, and I was only teasing because I do not think the early superhero movies from Superman in the 70s up until, even Nolan's Batman movies, those were still before this the Marvel took over and became this interconnected universe. So I think they're very different. Darkman, Swamp Thing, even Tim Burton's Batmans. They're their own things.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I like the Tim Burton Batmans, and even the Joel Schumacher Batmans are kind of fun in their own way, you know? So yeah, very different movies, like you said. And just from doing a little bit of research for this episode, like Swamp Thing, I think, was relatively recent when this movie was made. Like, you know, it was only an entity, an intellectual property in like the early 70s, 1972, I think, is when the first like standalone Swamp Thing title came out. So I think even when this movie was made in 1982, it was kind of a weird choice. Like, it wasn't one of the big superheroes at that time, you know? But then after the movie, Alan Moore kind of like recreated the character and it became a lot bigger. But at the time, I feel like this wasn't the obvious superhero choice for Wes Craven to take on. Well, yeah, I've already talked about Craven a little bit. I just feel like this period of his career is kind of interesting because, again, he had his like very low budget early horror movies. Very intense, brutal, gritty, dark, violent. The Hills Have Eyes, Last House on the Left. And then The Hills Have Eyes especially did so well that he was offered some projects that were like mid-tier budgets, semi-mainstream, but not quite there yet. And Swamp Thing is kind of in that period where he's still figuring things out. He's advancing from the early stage of his career, but he's not, you know, totally advanced to the super heights of stardom that A Nightmare on Elm Street would bring him to. So I just find this kind of a compelling, interesting period of his career where he's on his way up, but not quite there yet, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And again, Nightmare on Elm Street, probably my favorite horror movie of the 80s. Really great franchise. I will always love Wes Craven for that, if, you know, not for a lot of his other movies.
Well, Elm Street is a genre-defining piece of work.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I've seen that, and I've seen Scream, and I've seen this. I have not seen his other works.
Okay. The first two are really good. Last House on the Left is so hard to watch. It's very, very brutal, but no, I think it does have ideas, and it's like more than just kind of like a gritty exploitation grindhouse movie. And The Hills Have Eyes, you know, it's really well made on like a shoestring budget. So you can see why Craven would be an in-demand filmmaker at this time of his career. Like, he's able to do a lot with a very minuscule budget.
Yeah, you mentioned grindhouse. One review I was reading from Fangoria mentions that it's a critique of this writer anyways, that in Swamp Thing, you could see the kind of the tension between Craven's grindhouse background with Craven's desire to create a more mainstream movie.
Yeah.
And yet that dichotomy is at odds with itself in this movie at times, with the violence in an otherwise, I would say, PG-13 film.
Yeah. Totally, yeah. You see those like conflicting impulses, I think, in this movie. There's a really great quote from a critic, Gabriel Tice, I think is his name, at Fangoria magazine. He writes, "You can summarize Swamp Thing as either a sleazy creature from the Black Lagoon or an earnest toxic Avenger."
That's what I read. Yeah.
Like, I love that quote. I think it's totally spot on. And I think that kind of speaks to like what you're talking about, like sort of halfway in between grindhouse exploitation and like, you know, weirdly family friendly entertainment. It's all there in this movie. It's very strange.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So you found that Fangoria piece too.
Yeah. I loved it. I thought it was great.
Yeah. Well written.
Yeah, for sure. I might be referencing a couple other reviews throughout the episode as well, because there's a lot of good stuff about this movie online.
Yeah. We'll share those links with me and I'll put them in the show notes.
Yeah, for sure. They're at the end of this Google Doc, but.
Okay. Perfect. Yeah.
So yeah, Wes Craven, director, just a couple years away from A Nightmare on Elm Street, directing Swamp Thing. The producers, do you want to talk about the producers real quick?
The producers are Benjamin Meiniker?
Melniker, sorry.
Melniker. It's an L, not a capital I. Benjamin Melniker and Michael E. Uslan, who bought the film rights to several DC Comics properties, thanks in part to Uslan starting off as a writer there in 1975. These included Swamp Thing and, perhaps more lucratively, Batman.
Yeah, I mean, later on in the 80s, you know, Tim Burton made the first Batman movie, and those two producers, Melnicker and Uslan, would make a ton of bank off of it. So that, you know, Swamp Thing didn't maybe start off all that great for them. They did okay, but Batman would do a lot better for them. We'll just say that.
Batman, speaking of genre-defining films, I think Tim Burton's changed the game when it came to, as much as Superman did, Batman then further defined the genre for superhero films.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And Uslan, Michael E. Uslan, I'm not super familiar with comic books, but just reading a little bit more about his, he was an avid comic book fan. I don't think he's alive anymore, unfortunately, but, you know, he had like thousands and thousands of comic books when he was a kid and then became a writer for DC Comics in the 70s. And he wrote some installments of The Spirit and then I think of Swamp Thing as well. And then became the producer of this movie. So I just find that kind of a cool transition or evolution, one might say.
Yeah. And I love that. So yeah, he was coming to Swamp Thing and Batman with an eye for the material.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
The music is by Harry Manfredini, who worked on a lot of other horror films, including Friday the 13th and Wishmaster. And before I even knew Manfredini did the score, I was thinking to myself, this sounds like a Friday the 13th type of score. A lot of strings, a lot of like stings, which Manfredini, it must be noted, and I'm not slighting him at all. His score for Friday the 13th, 1980, is it's a, it, what am I saying? It's almost a blatant ripoff of the Psycho score.
Yeah. That is true. Yeah. Yep. And yeah, like it is a blatant ripoff of the Psycho score. And also like it was kind of, I feel like very influential on like slasher movies throughout the 80s. Cause there's this like very identifiable sort of like, like that sound, you know, and that's in like every slasher movie for like 10 years straight. And Swamp Thing's not a slasher movie, but that's kind of in this movie too. I feel like he's ripping off his own score a little bit for Swamp Thing, but somewhat effective.
Yeah, it works.
Yeah.
More power to him.
Turning a little bit to the cast of Swamp Thing, I feel like the real, well, maybe not the real star of this movie, but in terms of like, you know, on-screen actor doing her best, Adrienne Barbeau, who I love. I love Adrienne Barbeau so much. She is one of like the top five scream queens of all time. She's in so many John Carpenter movies, The Fog, Escape from New York, The Thing. She was also in Creepshow, a lot of TV shows throughout the years. Ironically, she doesn't like horror movies very much. I read in an interview, but she's great. I love her a lot. She plays a researcher in this movie who's kind of a sort of love interest for Swamp Thing. It's a very chaste kind of love interest, PG sort of subplot, you know, but
yeah,
she's great. What did you think about her performance in this movie?
I think she anchors the film for sure. She was actually married to John Carpenter at this time. And maybe we read the same interview with her. I found it on Inverse.
Yeah, that's what I read too. Yeah.
All right, look at us.
Cool. Research.
So yeah, I like her presence a lot.
I mean, her perm is terrible in this movie, but it's the 80s. You can't really blame her for that too much. So,
yeah.
No, she's great. Ray Wise plays the scientist Alec Holland, who is the scientist who was turned into Swamp Thing. I feel like for me and most other people our age, Ray Wise is mostly known as Leland Palmer from Twin Peaks, a very memorable and terrifying at times portrayal on that show. He's great. I feel like he always has a really good screen presence. He's also in Paul Schrader's Cat People, which we've talked about on the podcast, and Jeepers Creepers 2, kind of like those movies as well. So yeah, big Ray Wise fan. He has a kind of limited role in this movie, but he gives a good performance.
Yeah, and he does not play Swamp Thing, though. That goes to Dick Durock, who is a stuntman. He was 6'6", and he also worked on the Incredible Hulk TV show. I think he is great.
Yeah.
You know, with stunt performers, you know, sometimes it's just like, no pun intended, a Hulk behind a mask, right? Yeah. like, and we love the actors who do give life to some of these characters, like Jason Voorhees. And it's no detriment to that actor. I'm just comparing Jason Voorhees to Swamp Thing. The fact is, Swamp Thing doesn't wear a mask, so you're able to see his eyes and his, yeah. And he can speak. So he's more articulate, and I think Dick Durock provides a great bit of pathos to this character.
Yeah, totally agree. Yeah, he, and I think the dialogue is still by Ray Wise. I think they overdubbed his lines over Dick Durock's performance, but
oh, wow.
But you still see the eyes, you still see the soulful eyes, the body language of the character. It's really effective, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Rounding out the cast, we also have Louis Jourdan as the villainous Anton Arcane, a really great character name. Jourdan, he's an interesting actor. He's French, as the name implies. He started off in a lot of French movies during World War II. And then he came to Hollywood. He appeared in films like The Paradine Case by Alfred Hitchcock in 1947 and Letter from an Unknown Woman by Max Ophüls in 1948. Letter from an Unknown Woman is one of my favorite movies of all time. Fantastic. Louis Jourdan is great. Joan Fontaine is even better in that movie. But yeah, Louis Jourdan, you know, kind of had this reputation for being like a suave, cosmopolitan, sort of villainous presence, very handsome, but very untrustworthy in a lot of movies throughout his career. He also played a Bond villain in Octopussy from 1983, so 1 year after Swamp Thing. But he's a good villain in this movie. Maybe not a lot of depth to his character, but a good presence in this movie.
I just have to say, I think Swamp Thing is a better James Bond movie than Octopussy.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
That couple of things there. Before I even knew his connection to James Bond, I was thinking how James Bond this movie is, and I loved it. And then secondly, I think I have Octopussy ranked dead last on my list. No, it's either dead last or second to last on my rankings of the James Bond movies.
Wow, okay. I mean, I do understand that. I feel like for me, it would be like right in the middle of the pack. Okay. I kind of have a soft spot for Octopussy, and that's a weird way to say it. But, like, you know, I mean, like, some of the, like, late Sean Connery movies, like Diamonds Are Forever, the early Roger Moore ones, like The Man with the Golden Gun, this is quite a tangent. But, like, those are just, like, mean-spirited and nasty, whereas Octopussy, I think, is, like, kind of fun, but, like, bloated and overlong and kind of silly. So it's not my least favorite. It's definitely not very good. Yeah.
I think Diamonds Are Forever is also very bottom tier for me.
Yeah.
Might be the third worst on my list. But I actually think Man with the Golden Gun is one of my favorites. So my point is, it's so the James Bond franchise, I think everyone's going to come out differently.
Yeah.
Which is awesome. I love that. Totally. Yeah.
Yep. Totally subjective. Even more so than most other movies. But yeah, I think we can both agree that Octopussy is not the best James Bond movie. Jourdan is a decent Bond villain in that, but a way better Bond villain in Swamp Thing. I agree with you there.
Yeah.
He has like a secret lair. He has like a disguise that he like rips off very dramatically.
Yeah.
In the movie. That part's awesome.
He's a dungeon. He has a pit. It's just, yeah. He has henchmen.
Yeah.
He has deformed henchmen. Speaking about, you know, Man of the Golden Gun. It's just...
Oh, the henchmen in this movie are great. So, yeah, we're already kind of getting into the campy stuff a little bit, but I just love the henchmen in this movie so much, especially when one of them is turned into like a character that would not be out of place in the Island of Dr. Moreau, you know?
It's, yes.
I love it. It's great. It's so ridiculous. It's so campy. It's so fun. Yeah. Anton Arcane, the Bond villain that you never knew would be in this movie.
Seriously. But we have one more actor to get through.
Yeah, and I wanted to shout this young man out. I don't know what you thought about his performance, but Reggie Batts was just like a local teenager outside of, I think, Cypress Gardens, South Carolina is where they shot this movie. And he plays a young man named Jude. He's just a man who works, a young man, like a teenager, who works at a gas station, and he kind of befriends Alice and serves as her sidekick a little bit. his performance is really awkward. I think it's like not objectively a great performance. His line readings are so stilted and kind of uncomfortable. But I love it. He brings so much of his like natural personality and charisma to this role. I love all the scenes with him in this movie. I don't know if you felt the same way or not.
I do. I felt 100%. I've got good notes to say about him later on.
Okay.
And campy notes, but that's also good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's so cool. Like, so many filmmakers try to cast non-professional actors for their like lack of polish and their like natural personality. And I don't know if that was Wes Craven's intention in this movie, but I feel like it works here too. It's fun to watch.
It is.
Yeah, so some good cast and crew on this movie. Moving on to the production backstory of Swamp Thing. Like we already talked about, it was a pretty new DC Comics franchise, started in 1972. Wes Craven, you know, made a pretty big splash with his early movies, so he was offered this project. He started working on this at the same time that he was working on his previous movie, Deadly Blessing. So he was kind of, splitting his attention between those two projects. Wes Craven admitted that he wasn't really a big comic book fan, but he was attracted to some of the themes of Swamp Thing. You know, kind of some of the Frankenstein elements, the man versus nature storyline, and decided to dive in. He wrote the script himself and was eager to take on the project.
I love that Frankenstein is part and parcel of this research, because for any monster movie fans, it's not just the inspiration. You could see some overt homage, which I think is a good thing to the benefit of this film.
Yeah.
But the budget was only $2.5 million, which is really small. Superman's, Richard Donner's from just a few years prior, that film's budget was $55 million for context. And the Completion Bond Company constantly pressured Craven to cut costs, resulting in the screenplay being rewritten throughout production and the cutting of certain scenes, including an underwater escape through tunnels beneath the research lab. Wow. Wish we could have seen that.
Yeah.
And even entire characters. And it's Adrian Barbeau who is on record for discussing of the on-set cuts and rewrites.
Yeah.
Craven, sorry, Matt, what were you saying?
No, I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
Okay. Craven said, quote, "We had a very tough Completion Bond Company on this film. They were not friendly and they were not helpful. They just played the tough guys all the time. That was probably the most difficult part of the shoot, constantly having them looking over our shoulders towards the end of the film, especially just demanding that we cut scenes so that we could stay on schedule. The third act especially was just cut savagely. Having two inexperienced producers that signed the papers that they would bring it on budget, they were no help. We were all kind of okay, I guess. That's what we have to do or else you're fired," sort of thing. And just for reference, a completion bond is a kind of insurance for distributors of an independently financed film, which guarantees that the producer will deliver a completed film within the allotted budget. Wow, no pressure there.
Right.
The financial advisor even cast himself as one of the extras so he could be on set all the time, approving or disapproving costs.
Crazy.
Yeah, what? Okay, so here you go. According to Barbeau, "It was not a fantastic experience compared to so many of the other films that I've done. It was really hard on Wes. She had wonderful things to say about Craven, who did what he could with all these pressures and took a 2-year break from filmmaking afterwards, storming back with Nightmare on Elm Street. Supposedly, Craven got the idea for that franchise while working on this film." So there you go.
Yeah.
Wow, what a pressure cooker of a production.
Yeah, unfortunate. I mean, I feel like it's very obvious how the pressures of just, you know, turning a film in on time and under budget definitely impact the making of this movie. And mostly in negative ways, but in some pretty campy, entertaining ways at the same time.
Yeah, right. So, you know, you apply pressure to something, sometimes you get a diamond.
Right. Yeah, you kind of wonder like how good this movie could have been if Wes Craven in particular didn't have those pressures, but yeah, some good came out of it for sure.
And yeah,
we'll be talking about that soon enough.
Yeah.
Filming started in the summer of 1981 in Cypress Gardens, South Carolina. It was just a really miserable shoot, very hot and humid. There was a black caterpillar infestation, alligators and snakes all over the place. The hours were long. Cast accommodations were paltry, including no makeup or hair trailer whatsoever. So just not a fun shoot for anybody involved. Sort of like we already talked about, the original idea was for Ray Wise to play both Dr. Holland and Swamp Thing throughout the entire production, but it eventually became clear that that wouldn't really be possible. Dick Durack wearing the Swamp Thing costume is just so clearly not the same size and shape as Ray Wise, so that would not have worked out. Even so, Wes Craven did have Ray Wise perform all the scenes in the Swamp Thing costume for every scene that he appeared in the movie, so that probably did not help bring the movie in on time and under budget. So, yeah, unfortunate, but I like the idea behind that, to want to have Ray Wise play that role. It's kind of a cool idea, but obviously didn't work out in the long run.
Right. It's just two different body types.
Yeah. But yeah, Craven did say, like, Ray Wise was disappointed that he couldn't actually appear on screen as Swamp Thing. Wes Craven said that he was disappointed as well. But Vincent, like you said before, Dick Durack gives a good performance. He definitely has like a very poignant and natural kind of presence in the movie. The rubber suit, however, did not really hold up very well. The costume.
Say what?
Yeah, believe it or not, shockingly so. I mean, this thing was made out of like baling wire and gaffer's tape. Literally, that's what I think Craven said in the interview. So, you know, whenever it touched water, specifically this like very acidic swamp water, it would just like start to dissolve immediately, making the production even more difficult. Dick Durack would be stuck in that costume for 8 or 9 hours on end. He would pass out from heat exhaustion, and the crew would have to just like run in and like rip off his mask and his costume, and then it would take several hours to reapply, just to, you know, literally save this guy's life and not have him like pass out from heat exhaustion. So in a way, like every obstacle and hardship they could have experienced on this production, they kind of did at some point.
Right. And Durack couldn't go to the bathroom. And this is where maybe more budget could have. If there's one thing I wanted more budget to, it was the costume.
Mm-hmm.
If just for the sake of Durack.
Right.
Yeah.
Poor guy.
Like, give him a fly. It's not that hard.
Right.
Not in the budget. Can't do it.
And I feel like you hear so many stories about that from monster movies, where actors have to like sit in a makeup chair for like 4 or 5 hours, and then they're stuck there all day and they can't go to the bathroom and all this stuff. It's, you know, it's a sacrifice for art. And sometimes you're like, ah, was it really worth it? I don't know.
There has to be a way to make it accommodating.
Yeah. And this is kind of a vulgar thought, but you know, there is this kind of like chaste romance between Swamp Thing and the Alice Cable character. But like the costume of Swamp Thing is totally like, there's no genitalia at all. And I was kind of like, I kind of want to see what Swamp Thing has to offer, you know, like what's he got swinging down there? Like, why is she attracted to him so much? You know, I'm being a little crude right now, but I was like, there's just nothing down there. It's weird.
Well, that would be the rated R version. I think it could be done tastefully, you know, as tastefully as maybe a Grindhouse movie could be.
Right.
But no, that's not the version we get.
Yeah. Swamp Thing is rated PG after all. And I'm kind of joking a little bit, but I would like to see that version of the movie too.
Well, he would have an enormous Schunstiger.
Yeah. As they say in Young Frankenstein, you would certainly assume so. Yeah.
Okay. I can read this last bit.
Yeah, for sure.
So Wes Craven apparently wasn't a fan of the monster suit after Arcane's transformation. Oh, right. So we get two monsters in this movie, folks. And the final act is Arcane taking the serum that has turned other people, including Swamp Thing, into these monsters. So Arcane, our villain, he takes the potion and it turns him into what is the essence of his being, a fiendish rat man. And it's wild. But anyways, we'll talk about that later.
Oh, yeah.
Craven wasn't a fan of Arcane's transformation. Asked about it by an interviewer, he simply sighed heavily while they were shooting in South Carolina. The Arcane suit was being designed. Okay. While they were shooting in South Carolina, the Arcane suit was being designed in LA. So Craven literally didn't see it until it arrived on set. He said, quote, "I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings on this because everyone was working very hard. But given the budgets that we didn't give to them, basically they had very little to work with. It was kind of a chaotic thing from the beginning, I think. There probably should have been 5 times more money for this costume and more time to develop and test and everything else, and there just wasn't." And to be frank, this costume is like a bad Halloween costume. It just doesn't look cinematic at all. With that said, it lends the perfect amount of camp to this film.
Oh, yeah.
it's fantastic.
Yeah. Not to mention the fact that this arcane monster is like wielding a huge sword in that final fight. So it's just so ridiculous.
So bad it is good.
Yeah, absolutely. The epitome of that phrase, I would say.
Yep.
Yeah, but yeah, no, it does not look probably the way that Wes Craven wanted it to, as he admitted. Nevertheless, when Swamp Thing was released in February of 1982, it was a moderate box office success, partially because of its low budget. I mean, it gained such a cult following that it even led to a sequel, The Return of Swamp Thing, in 1989.
And a couple of TV series.
Yeah.
One with Dick Durack following The Return of Swamp Thing. I think it was like a 3-season run on the USA Network. Mm-hmm. Which I would be into watching. And then I think James Wan produced a more recent TV series that I don't think had such an extended life. But
yeah,
there's a lot of properties out there, including James Gunn. He is producing a new movie with James Mangold attached.
Hmm.
It keeps being put off on the back burner because Mangold is off directing arguably, you know, bigger named movies, Star Wars and
A Complete Unknown.
Yeah. So with that said, a new Swamp Thing is percolating out there in the swamp. Mm. But I hope it doesn't, I hope it doesn't fall into the quicksand, to continue the metaphor. I want it to, I want it to rise from the depths.
I love that metaphor. I wonder if Timothée Chalamet will play Swamp Thing in the James Mangold version.
That would be dumb.
I really hope that's not the case. That was just a joke, by the way.
No, I know. He could play maybe the villain.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah. I have some ridiculous mental images in my head right now.
Maybe we'll get the unrated cut. So you can get what you were missing in this Wes Craven version.
Man, I take back everything I said. I don't actually want that. Speaking of that, though, there was a European release of Swamp Thing at the same time that the American Swamp Thing was released into theaters in 1982, and the Completion Bond Company sort of stipulated that there would be a lot more nudity in the European version, so there are gratuitous shots of Adrian Barbeau topless in the European cut of Swamp Thing, which makes no sense because this is essentially a rated PG, mostly family-friendly story, like a superhero story. And I just don't know why you would have this like sexualized European version of the film. It makes no sense at all.
It was the 80s. I don't know.
I guess that's all. Yeah, it was the 80s. That's all the explanation you need. Terrible time for everyone, the 1980s. There's kind of a funny story, though. Like, the initial DVD release of Swamp Thing was supposed to be the rated PG version, but they accidentally released the European cut with way more nudity than there was supposed to be in it. And at least one parent complained about it. The distributor had to recall all the DVDs. They put the right version of the movie on there. That's kind of unfortunate, but it's also hilarious to imagine a mom being like, where are all these topless scenes coming from? This is supposed to be Swamp Thing. I kind of love that story.
I'm just picturing, I mean, how old was this kid, first of all? Yes, this movie may be more family-friendly in tone, but I wouldn't show a young kid this movie.
Mm.
Because it's still violent. I don't know. My point is, if you're showing your kids Swamp Thing, what's a little bit of nudity?
Yeah, right. I mean, the nudity is probably less offensive than Swamp Thing, like crushing villains' heads.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. But it's weird because, like, the tone in this movie is pretty, like, silly and cutesy and family friendly. Like, even the stuff where villains die, like, there's some fake blood, but, like, you don't really see too much, so... Yeah. It's just a weird combination of tones, and you already talked about this a little bit, Vincent. It's like, you know, is this Wes Craven in, like, early grindhouse exploitation mode, or is it him in, like, mainstream family-friendly mode? It's very awkwardly in between, which is fascinating, but does not really make for a very good movie. But now is probably a good time for our sponsor break. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the show notes. Vincent, do we have anything in Minya's mailbox today?
We do. Something super quick, but super. We have a comment from a listener named Kiora123, and Kiora simply says, "You guys are amazing."
Goodness, thank you, Kiora123. That's awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much. That's good to hear.
Yeah. I've got other really good comments in the mailbag, but I want to save them when we have time to dedicate to them because I think they offer some conversation. But for now, you know, we'll just leave it at that. And
absolutely. Many thanks. Thank you for listening, sharing, commenting, all the above. We really appreciate you.
Matt, how's life with Peter?
Oh, it's a little bit rough sometimes. Let me tell you, there's some friction. Yeah.
Like the Odd Couple here.
Trouble in paradise. That's all I'll say. It's tough cohabitating with somebody, especially diminutive German fiend. I'll just say that. Yeah.
Diminutive German fiends. Well, I hope he doesn't hear you call him that.
I heard like a shriek from the room behind me. So I think he is listening in right now. He's not very happy. And I think things are about to get even worse. So I will bear the brunt of that.
Well, I don't think I've told you. I mean, I should. You're privy to this. You're his roommate, for goodness sake. So this lilac he's growing, he got word out to me that it is reaching the ceiling now. Mm. And it's grown fangs and it's squawking and it demands fish heads.
Oh.
And I try to get through to Peter, but I don't live with the guy. So maybe you have his ear a little bit more and you could really kind of talk him down from this. I don't think this lilac is good for him.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That could be what the shrieking is right now. It might be totally unrelated to me and more about the fanged lilac in his tiny closet. That could be. Well, I'll try to talk him down. I'll try to like produce some more fish heads. Let me tell you, it does not feel good to decapitate dozens of fish every week.
I didn't know you prepared them.
Oh yeah, lovingly. I mean, I try to make sure they're the best fish that I can possibly find. So, you know, I mean, I'm doing what I can for Peter and he's not appreciative. I'll tell you that much.
You're very kind. At this point, I would tell a grown man to cut his own fish heads.
Oh, well, I keep him under lock and key in his closet. So he doesn't
really do
that very much. Yeah. He's just too intrusive otherwise.
Wow. Well, he seems to be okay with that arrangement because I haven't heard that. But, you know, whatever works for you too, I'm not going to get into your personal business. You know, as long as he's paying his half of the rent, right?
Well, sometimes. Yeah. When I threaten him, the more I talk about it, the more I understand why our relationship is a little rough right now. I think I understand. Yeah.
Well, he's dealing with some things. So, you know, we'll look for some improvements.
Yeah. You know, I'll talk to him. We'll sit down with a domestic counselor. We'll figure things out. It'll be okay.
Okay.
More to come on that soon. I should check out that lilac, though. I'm a little scared of that.
Yeah, you might want to stay on top of that. In the meantime, check out a movie called The Mad Monster from 1942. I think it's about a mad scientist turning people into wolfmen.
Hmm. Okay.
I haven't seen it yet, but I cannot wait to watch The Mad Monster and hear Peter Lorre talk all about it.
I feel like that title could apply to Swamp Thing and many, many other monster movies.
Many others.
Yeah. The vast majority, perhaps. Well, I can't wait to hear more about it.
Welcome to Poverty Row Studios on the other side of Hollywood, where the stars were dimmer and the red carpets dripped with blood. Together we will watch the best of the worst, movies known for their limited budgets, outlandish concepts, and questionable performances. But with enough haunted houses, zombies, ape men, and devil bats to keep you up at night, this is the Poverty Row Picture Show. I dare you to sleep through these nightmares. Hello there, I am Peter Lorre. You may remember me from such hard-boiled classics as The Maltese Falcon and Casablanca. No? You don't remember me? Yes, with Humphrey Bogart. Yes, the Casablanca. No, not with the Marx Brothers, you know, forget it. See, this is what I get for doing something outside the horror genre. Fine, you want monsters, is it? Spooks, specters, and ghosts? All right, then here is a doozy for you this week. From PRC comes The Mad Monster, starring fellow horror icon George Zucco as a mad scientist who concocts a scheme to transfer a wolf's blood into the hulking dim-witted gardener. The madman's aim is to sick the genetically engineered wolfman on those colleagues who spurned his experiments. And if that wasn't enough, perhaps these wolfmen will be unleashed upon Hitler's German army. A little Frankenstein, a little wolfman, a little devil bat. This is a million-dollar idea that simply cannot meet its own lofty aspirations. The direction by Sam Neufeld is sadly void of suspense, terror, and mystery. Compounding this is an inexplicable lack of scoring in such moments. The Wolf Man, played by Glenn Strange, is a decent screen monster if you can look past his dopey overalls and bucket hat. But Mr. Strange proves worthy of inheriting the Frankenstein monster as he did in the final three pictures of Universal's famed series. As the mentally impaired gardener, however, Mr. Strange is tasked with a characterization that is embarrassing at best and offensive at worst, and will let you consider the long history of medical abuse among our disabled brethren. Oh, that must be Matthew home from the market. Oh, I can smell the salty stench of the herring from here. What do you think, Lilac? Ready to have some din-din? Oh, yes, I'll scratch your belly. Oh, there's a good girl, good girl. All right, listeners, please check out Mad Monster for yourself. It is no Casablanca, but it might be so bad it's good. As for next time, we will review Bowery at Midnight, where Bela Lugosi plays a gangster with a basement full of zombies. By Satan's beard, with a premise like that, it better be a masterpiece of the macabre.
The big green guy is back.
They call me Swamp Thing.
You're a plant, aren't you?
He's come back to settle the score.
Find him and bring him in.
He's got a grudge, cause they turned him to sludge.
I believe it's yours.
What?
The return of Swamp Thing. Starring Louis Jordan.
What did you do? Sell your soul to the devil?
Let's just say he has a lease with an option to buy.
Heather Locklear.
She can get in my game, then that's most things.
Why can't men be more like plants? I mean, you can stroke a plant and it doesn't get the wrong idea.
And Swamp Thing.
But I can't give you the kind of love you want.
Why not?
I'm a plant.
That's okay. I'm a vegetarian.
The return of Swamp Thing. He's turning over a new leaf for love.
back to Swamp Thing. What are the themes in this movie?
Well, I picked up on a couple that I found interesting. Number one is the serum, and this Swamp Thing is chained up in the dungeon of Arcane, and Arcane's ploy to, like, not take over the world, but to... he wants to take over this serum for his own personal gain, at any rate.
Yeah.
And he sees that drinking the serum turned, I forget, Swamp Thing's human alter ego.
Like Holland, I believe.
Holland, that's yeah. Right. Arcane sees that the serum turns Holland into this superhuman. And Arcane says, I want some of that. But he tries it out, the serum, on his henchman, one of his goons. But the serum turns the goon into like a diminutive satyr-like mm-hmm. goblin character.
Yeah.
Real freakish. So Arcane is interrogating Swamp Thing and says, why? Why can't everyone just be like you?
Yeah.
And Swamp Thing says, because the serum amplifies your essence, which I think is a really profound and almost poetic way to phrase this and frame this device, this story device, because Arcane takes it and again turns into this like really nightmare rodent like creature.
Yeah.
And so I just love the theme of exploring one's own identity and can you change who you are? Mm. According to this movie, you can't. You can only amplify it. So right. The lines between good and bad are very clear in this movie.
Yeah.
Which is right in line with the film's tone and approach as a superhero movie. But yeah, I found it a really interesting thought.
Yeah. I like that theme, even if like, yeah, the morality does seem a little bit like black or white. You're either like a good person or a bad person, you know, that maybe could have been more interesting. But yeah, the theme is pretty fascinating. And like, the moment when that henchman turns into like the little satyr like creature is really funny and also kind of disturbing at the same time. It really did remind me of the Island of Dr. Moreau, which we just talked about a couple months ago.
Oh yeah. Honestly, it Marlon Brando's mini me character yeah. is almost cut from the same cloth. You just wonder if the people behind Moreau did take inspiration from Swamp Thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I also think the idea of genius and what constitutes genius, but also the responsibility of being a genius is an interesting thread to pull in this movie, because Arcane, as he often says in this movie, he is a genius. And he's one really great line that sums up his worldview. And he says to Holland, talent does what it can. Genius does what it must.
Mm. Yeah.
And I find that fascinating in our current age of people like Elon Musk and all these self-described geniuses. And, you know, are they using their resources and their smarts for the betterment of mankind? But on the flip side, like, at what cost? At whose expense? At what compromise to your own ethics and morality of right and wrong? Are you gonna destroy lives to achieve this quote-unquote greatness? And that's a duality that maybe supervillains play, maybe a Lex Luthor type, but Arcane personifies that duality.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a common theme from monster movies. I think we see that in Island of Lost Souls with Charles Laughton's character, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. We see that a little bit too. So it's a longstanding theme, but I like what you said about Elon Musk and just like this era of human history. Like I think this, well, and it goes back to like nuclear weaponry as well. Like it's certainly in a lot of kaiju movies. It's in, you know, them, the day the earth stood still a little bit, like implicitly, you know, so... yeah, certainly a pervasive theme, but I think at this point in human history, that question is more relevant than ever. Like, we need people of genius to innovate and come up with new solutions. But then, like, what do you do with that science? Do you, like, you know, Arcane uses it for money and power. Like, he wants to, like, control the world's food supply so that people pay him to, like, be able to eat, basically. And then Alec Holland, you know, he wants to feed everybody. He's driven by world starvation and famine throughout the planet, and he wants to help everybody. He wants to make sure that nobody dies of starvation ever again. So it's kind of a simple-minded duality, but it's still a very important one, and it's one that, like, you know, we see playing out in the real world over and over again.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we also get this man versus nature theme, which is maybe the most obvious and possibly, like, the less interesting theme in the movie, but it's certainly there. I mean, Holland loves the swamps. He's one with nature. Literally, he's one with nature at a certain point in the movie. So, you know, that's right there on the surface, but still a duality in the movie for sure.
Yeah, which, as I've read now, was kind of a common theme for Wes Craven movies. I haven't seen these other movies. I'm just regurgitating what I read, but he likes to examine the environment's relationship on his characters.
Yeah, for sure. And that's maybe one more review that I'll just shout out here real quick. I hope I pronounced this writer's name correctly, but Jakub Flosch is my guess on how to pronounce his name. But, you know, he compares Swamp Thing to Craven's earlier movies, The Last House on the Left and The Hills Have Eyes, which were satires of, like, hippie counterculture and then, like, nuclear weaponry and, like, the atomic age. Respectively, those two movies kind of address those themes. So this critic is saying that Swamp Thing kind of continues that legacy and is offering another satire about the role of science in society. And I think, you know, looking at Craven's filmography, I think that depth is certainly there, even if it is compromised a little bit by some of the production difficulties during the making of this movie.
Yeah, certainly.
But, you know, some themes in Swamp Thing, for sure. And at the same time, a lot of camp, a lot of ridiculousness, and some very bad monster costumes, for better or worse. Do you want to talk about the form and aesthetic separately, or should we work that into our final breakdowns here?
Let's just go through these, because I think there are plenty of good thoughts here.
Yeah, for sure.
So there's some solid stunt work in the film, including a highly entertaining moment where Swamp Thing flips over a motorboat single-handedly. Yeah, the wire work with the stunts is campy, but in the best way.
I love it. And, like, it's not CGI, so, like, you see stuntmen, like, flying through the air and, like, a boat being demolished and all that. It's great. It's fun to watch.
Holland, he's set on fire that night. The goons and Arcane's men just blow everything up. He's set on fire. He crashes through the wall and dives into the lake. It is top-notch stunt work, and it's so thrilling, a picture on screen. At that moment, I was hooked by this movie.
Yeah.
And what Craven's doing with the fog, and there's a lot of great green lighting in that sequence.
Yeah.
Really, I think, impressive use of lighting and smoke and using his location to enhance whatever is happening.
Totally. And like you said, just the stunt work of this man who is completely on fire. And you watch that and you're like, how did this guy not die? It's like, yeah, it's breathtaking. And, like, honestly, up until that point in the movie, I was like, this is cheesy. This is slow. This is not really working very well. And then, like, that scene happens and you're like, oh, I'm hooked. Like you said, like, it's great. It's a really, really good scene. Yeah. You know, I do love the suitmation in this movie. Like, at times it did remind me of, like, a good old-fashioned Toho kaiju movie where it's, like, two men in a suit going at each other. And the costumes themselves maybe are not all that great. But still, like, just the tactility of it, the kind of, like, charming, like, do-it-yourself aspect of it. I sort of like the climactic fight in this movie, even though it's not very well done, but it's still so much fun to watch.
So much fun. And the arcane creature has, like you said, this big, like, broadsword, and they're dueling it out in a lake, and there's so much fog. Just, they crank the fog machines up, and it was like a fantasy picture.
Yeah.
It was just like a feast for the eyes. I was like, this is so, it looks so dumb, but yet so awesome at the same time.
Totally. It's kind of irresistible. Like, yeah. It's what you kind of imagine a young boy reading a Swamp Thing comic book, like what's going through his head at the time, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
I love that aspect of it. And, you know, I don't know how you feel about this, but I know you really love the movie Creature from the Black Lagoon, right? And this movie reminded me of that as well.
Absolutely. I mean, it's an obvious comparison, but there are some shots of Swamp Thing carrying Cable around in his arms tenderly that I was like, yep, that's straight from Jack Arnold's Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah.
But also Frankenstein, the 1931 Universal movie, is a really tender shot when Swamp Thing is tied up in the dungeon and he's reaching his hand towards a shaft of light. And that is straight from James Whale's movie.
Yeah.
But it's not ripping off. It's homage.
Yeah.
There is a difference. I mean, maybe I can't quite describe that difference, but in Swamp Thing, it's homage and it's beautiful.
It is beautiful. That's the word I was thinking of as well. And like, you know, in Swamp Thing, he's like reaching up his hand so that like the sun will like strengthen him. And like, then he like grows a new branch basically. And that's kind of like the context of the scene. But yeah, it's more than that. It's like, it goes back to the man versus nature scene. And Swamp Thing is more one with nature than anybody else in this movie. Like, he's strengthened by the sun. It's a beautiful moment. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's time for our individual breakdowns here on Camp Kaiju. As always, we talk about the good, the bad, and the campy. Again, I think there's a lot of good stuff in Swamp Thing.
I also think there's a lot of good things in Swamp Thing. Things in Swamp Thing. The use of the location is awesome. On set, you know, it might have been a pain in the butt for a cast and crew, but it adds so much realism to this movie. Oh, another tender moment is Swamp Thing smelling the flowers in his lab. He goes back to the ruins of his laboratory. And that's what I want to really, my main takeaway of this film is on the surface, it's an campy action monster movie. But I think in contrast to what modern 21st century directors would do, Wes Craven is really comfortable taking his time with moments of quiet tenderness, if that makes sense. So you have the flower moment, you have the moment with the beam of light, and like the movie just stops, but it's breathing. It's just giving us time to appreciate the quieter moments of the story before we're back on the roller coaster. And I love that. I just appreciate that so much. I think that helps enhance a movie's longevity, for instance, and makes it more than just, you know, a campy action monster movie.
Yeah. I totally agree with everything you said. There's one shot in this movie that I really love where Alice Cable, she passes out at some point and Swamp Thing rescues her. And then she wakes back up and she's like drenched in sunlight and she's like lying on his chest. And there's like fog, like you said, like everywhere throughout. It's a gorgeous image and just like a really tender image too. And like, I think it's the same scene where she asks him if it hurts to be Swamp Thing instead of the Alec Holland human character. And he's like, only when I laugh. And that's just such a, yeah, it's a Frankenstein moment, you know, like it's so human. It's so touching. And in the midst of all this silliness and like the weird kind of like grindhouse tone of the movie sometimes, it just really stuck out to me. And, you know, not to dwell too much on like the movie's production backstory, but just to see what Craven is able to do with like really arduous production circumstances and still make something that has a lot of personality and charm, that has a lot of imagination to it, that really resists a lot of the sort of like superhero cliches that as we talked about, have become a little bit too predominant in like some of the more mainstream movies recently. It's, you know, I think like this version of Swamp Thing is very touching and charming. It has like an innocence to it that's kind of irresistible sometimes.
Absolutely. And I like that you mentioned that line, because there are few other lines I need to shout out, because in a movie like this, like poetry sticks out, and there's some lines of dialogue that really, really do that. The first is that I have here is, I believe it's Swamp Thing. He says, "Everything's a dream when you're alone."
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, beautiful. Damn. Yeah. And then I think it's Bruno, the sidekick, or maybe it's the leader of the henchmen. Someone says, "It's every man for himself and God against all." I was like, whoa. Yeah. I love that line.
Which is a reference to a Werner Herzog movie of that title from the 70s.
Yes, which that was intentional on Craven's part. I think he took some inspiration from that film.
Mm-hmm.
But then a hilarious line from the actor who plays Jude. So before I get to the line, the Jude character is apparently killed by this band of white men. And
Jude is a young black man. I don't think we've mentioned that before, but I feel like it's kind of relevant.
Absolutely. And you know, you see a posse of white men murder a black boy. I'm thinking about Emmett Till. Like, yeah. I'm a student of history, so this movie got very dark all of a sudden. And I was ready to be mad at this movie for being mean to kill off this character. But I think it's a great reveal. Swamp Thing has a superpower where he can rejuvenate people's lives and injuries. So yeah, he actually brings Jude back to life, and Jude's bleary eyed and he looks up at Swamp Thing for the first time and he says, "Oh shit, there goes the neighborhood."
Yeah, I love that moment. That's like right on the border between campy and good. It's both, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Yeah. I just totally agree with you. Like, I was ready to be like, oh, this is such a manipulative, cheap movie to like pull our heartstrings in that way. And then to like kind of diffuse that a little bit through that line of dialogue and also through Reggie Batts' performance. It's funny and touching at the same time, for sure. Well, you know, I mentioned that like the inconsistent tone is a bad thing. Maybe I'll go through my bad category real quick and then I'll turn it over to you. But, you know, I think there's a sense of like what could have been if like the production circumstances hadn't been so difficult during the making of this movie. Like we mentioned like the scene of like Cable and Swamp Thing like escaping through the underwater tunnels. That would have been amazing. I think if there had been like better costumes for both Swamp Thing and the arcane monster, that could have been awesome. You know, I just think you get the sense that like Craven or maybe the producers didn't really know what they wanted. Like, do they want a sleazy grindhouse movie? Do they want a family friendly, like touching fantasy? Do they want this like, you know, deeper analysis of the role of science and the role of nature? I don't think this movie really knows what it wants to be. And that can be entertaining sometimes, but it's also frustrating. Like, this movie could have been a lot better if Craven had been able to like make the movie that he wanted to make. And, you know, maybe even if he had had like totally free reign, maybe he wouldn't have been able to pull it off. But I think you can see that like this movie was doomed from the start with like its difficult shoot and like the producers sort of like imposing all these ridiculous demands on it. This movie could have been a lot better than it is.
Yeah, I think it's that tension of tones for sure. I appreciate this movie because I appreciate these kinds of movies that are a little messy but have a lot of heart. But I wonder, you know, you show this to anybody on the street who maybe doesn't have this context that we do, you know, if I feel like for me, it's a little too violent to show to a younger kid. And yet to show to an older person, it might be too silly and offbeat.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I love that murkiness. But to the average person on the street, you can maybe see why this did not do well at the box office.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you can simultaneously see that and understand why maybe it's developed a little bit of a cult following since then. Because it is so bizarre and so, like, unlike most other superhero movies that have been made since then. But
yeah,
it definitely does not work as it's intended to.
Right.
Whatever that is. Yeah.
Right. I think there's a lot of Cable running around being chased in this movie, which gets a little tiresome at times. Just a lot of running, and like she gets caught and then she escapes, only to then get caught again and then get saved again. It happens like over and over and over again, but that's a minor thing. And then here you go, Matt. If you wonder why Cable is kind of maybe in love with Swamp Thing, it's ostensibly because she knew Holland as a human. And they develop this relationship. However, that relationship is unconvincing to me because he comes off as a total sleaze.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, like there's nothing charming about his performance towards her. In fact, I mean, he smooches her. This is a campy thing I have because it actually came off more campy than offensive because it's just so ridiculous that he lands a big one on her.
Yeah. Yeah, like forcefully. Yeah.
I know. but aside from that, like he's trying to make moves on her in the swamps. And I'm just like, who is this guy?
Yeah.
And she sees right through it. Maybe if she had given me an inkling of, you know what, you are kind of cute. Then, to your question, I could buy her falling for Swamp Thing a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah, that I forgot to mention one of like the biggest hurdles for me in this movie, which is their relationship, especially in the moment when he kisses her and like, yeah, I like, yeah, again, like very forcefully, and she's clearly not expecting it. And then like also the relationship between Dr. Holland and his sister, although at first you think that she's his wife and Cable thinks that as well. And there are some lines of dialogue that like suggest either could be the case. Like, for the first half an hour of this movie, I was like, wait a minute, are they siblings or are they actually married? Like, you have no idea until, like, there's a fairly clear line of dialogue about it eventually. But, like, it's pretty creepy and sleazy. And I don't think that was the intention behind that kind of ambiguity, you know?
Yep.
Yeah. Weird.
It's weird.
And, yeah, like, even, like, she does turn out to be his sister, but then there's this weirdly sort of like romantic, semi-incestuous relationship between them. Like she calls him darling at one point, and I don't know. It's very bizarre. Yeah. Well,
what happens in the swamp stays in the swamp.
Right. I mean, I guess, you know, a couple of years in that bayou, you don't know what's going to happen. So much campy stuff. We've already talked about so much campy stuff. I do want to talk about the amazing transitions, like scene transitions in this movie. There are some star wipes, kind of like Star Wars style, but like way cheaper than Star Wars did it. There's even like a slime wipe where it looks like slime is like falling down the screen and that transitions to the next scene.
I love the slime wipe.
Man, so ridiculous. It's like, that is the epitome of camp. Well, maybe not the epitome. That's like a broad term to begin with, but just such a cheesy moment. I love it. It's like what like a middle schooler would like do through like very primitive, like Final Cut effects, and be like so proud of, you know?
Yeah, Windows Movie Maker.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, just whatever program came on your computer.
Yeah. But I love it. It's ridiculous.
Yep. I've mentioned so many of my campy things, but here's what I haven't mentioned. There's a Wilhelm scream in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
That I loved.
Yeah, I loved that too. I put that in my notes that I took during the movie. And it's during one of the moments where, like, Swamp Thing, like, tips over a boat that's coming at him, like, full speed. It's great.
Yeah.
So cool. There's also a moment where one of the henchmen is talking about how, like, he thinks that the other goons on Arcane's team thinks that Swamp Thing is one of the abdominal snowmen's. And I'm, like, that has to be an intentionally funny line, but it's so charmingly uttered, and it's, like, so out of nowhere. I really love that moment. It's great.
Yeah.
And that's the guy Bruno, who then is turned into like the short satyr-like guy. So
yeah, he was a good character. He, I think, was properly sympathetic so that when he did turn into a monster, I felt bad for him genuinely.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of a disturbing moment and funny at the same time.
Yeah.
All the clothes that he wears are way too tight. And I feel like that adds to the sympathy a little bit, you know? Like, dude, just get a bigger shirt. But I love you at the same time. Yeah, I like, you know, this movie is so much camp. We could mention a lot more, but listeners, you're going to have to watch it for yourself and see how much camp there actually is in this movie. It's a lot. So, at the end, we always give each movie a rating here on Camp Kaiju. As always, our highest rating is, it's a timeless classic. It definitely stands the test of time. Number two, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great. It stands the test of time. Number three, it may be historically significant or just fun, but it does not stand the test of time. And our lowest rating, it's not worth revisiting. It definitely does not stand the test of time.
All right. Well, I'm happy to go first.
Well, sure. Yeah. If you don't mind, that sounds good.
Yeah. I think Swamp Thing from 1982 has some antiquated moments. I don't think it's a perfect movie, but it's a hell of a lot of fun. And I think it does stand the test of time. I was not hooked by this movie in the first act, but once Swamp Thing or Holland turns into Swamp Thing with the fire and everything we talked about, this movie dials it up to 11. And from then on, every scene just sunk its hooks deeper into me until by the end, I was like, this is not the movie we started with, people. We have gone to a distant planet all of a sudden. Some sword and sandal monster movie. And it's a James Bond movie. It is Wes Craven made a James Bond movie, and this is it. And it's awesome. I love the mix of tone and genre, as messy as it is. So I think Swamp Thing does stand the test of time. Not a classic, but certainly worth checking out.
I love it, and I totally agree. To me, yeah, definitely some antiquated moments. Overall, it's so fun. It's very charming. I think it does stand the test of time. In fact, I would say that as time goes on, maybe it'll get even richer. Like, I feel like there have just been so many serious, overlong, CGI-filled superhero movies. I'm sorry to dwell on that again. But, like, you know, in comparison, something like this that's so, you know, again, charming and just, like, interesting, it seems to have that sort of like comic book innocence to it. It just makes me love it even more as time goes on. So yeah, objectively, is it a great movie? I don't know if you could really say that, but I just want to stick up for it. There's so much that I love about it. It's really charming. It's very fun. Yeah. It's, you know, see Swamp Thing for yourself if you haven't seen it yet. I bet you will be delighted, or at least mystified in the best possible way.
Mystified. That's the word. That's the sentiment. Yeah, I'm Team Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
Thank you, Matt, for picking this movie, though you may not know why you did. Something just called to you.
Yeah, I guess so. Sort of like how Wes Craven had a dream and that led to A Nightmare on Elm Street during the making of this movie. I had a dream where I wanted to talk about Swamp Thing, and I'm very glad we're doing so tonight. Yeah. Even better than I thought it would be. Well, better in its own way. I'll just say that. Awesome. I'm so glad you like this movie, Vincent. Anybody listening, I hope you like it as well. We'll see you next time on Camp Kaiju for Robot Jocks with Sean and Sean. So excited for that. Thank you again for hanging out. Please rate and review wherever you listen. You can also share this podcast with a friend, subscribe to the website, and send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com or on Instagram. Links are in the show notes. If you'd like to be a featured voice on the show, please leave a voicemail at 612-470-2612 telling us about your favorite monster movies and memories. Please check out our website, campkaijupodcast.com, for more information. Camp Kaiju is recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul, with Minia's Mailbox music by Ben Cook Feltz. Thanks again, friends, and until next time, stay campy. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the show notes.
Oh, shit. There goes the neighborhood.